Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, or rather, wet evening. This lecture is on the caricatural. In the last two lectures, I attempted to lay out the reasons why naturalism was the dominant aesthetic in late 19th century French culture, as well as some of the parameters in which it operated. I argued that naturalism's centrality was aided by its stylistic flexibility, its ability to embrace a wide range of artistic personalities. Paradoxically, however, naturalist painting could also be criticised as being style-less, its commitment to the descriptive suppressing creative personality. Indeed, the more naturalism seemed to become entrenched, even semi-official, the closer the elision between naturalist forms of representation and the broad currents of republicanism, with its emphasis on the consensual, the egalitarian, the scientific and progressive, the more there were reactions. These might be demands for other forms of representation which were less positive and materialist, that allowed greater individual expression, that articulated other ideologies, Catholic perhaps, or anarchist, which countered the republican hegemony. At this point, you might expect my lectures to continue with a discussion of symbolism and its manifestations in visual culture, or analyses of groups such as the Neo-Impressionists or the Nabi. But while I do not for a moment deny the importance of such aesthetics and groupings, I want to strike out along less familiar paths. In the next three lectures, I will examine issues of style. By style, I mean more than the individual articulation of creative means, line, colour, touch, design, and include the deliberate, even willful, personalisation of making in reaction to the hegemony of description. This will involve looking at a wide range of visual material from the period and analysing it not according to conventional classifications, but by using new prisms, the caricatural, the populaire, and the organicist. The aim is not to replace one set of style labels with another, but to suggest that by looking more broadly across mentalité and visual culture than is often done, we can enrich our understanding of the period. Nor do I plan to let go of naturalism. One of my lines of inquiry will be to gauge to what extent my new formulations were modifications of or reactions against the naturalist aesthetic and its republican matrix. I also want to explore how avant-garde art, so often considered in terms of solitary individuals or in restrictive silos, the Neo-Impressionists, the Nabi, might be understood afresh if situated within less familiar stylistic contexts. Determined to ignore that vacuous rubric post-impressionism, these next three lectures will try to pioneer alternative ways of looking at style in late 19th century French art and culture. The caricatural is not a tightly definable stylistic term in art history. Caricature, of course, is a crucial concept, and the exaggeration or deformation of facial and physical characteristics to satirise or raise a laugh had a long history before early Third Republic France. Today, I want to suggest that the caricatural might be used as a means of discussing style at this period, and I will use it loosely to cover pictorial idioms and attitudes that seem to me to be rooted in caricature. My central premise is that caricature flourished in France during the 1880s and 90s, and that, deeply entrenched in contemporary mentalité, it significantly inflected much avant-garde art, linking artists as different as Seurat, Gauguin and Bonnard. This lecture aims to explore why and how this happened. In 1894, Jean Grand Carteret, perhaps France's leading expert on caricature, argued that across the board, the image becomes more important and literature declines. The sympathies of the public reach out to the graphic, to what can be seen and understood without difficulty. He cited the Bordeaux newspaper La Petite Gironde's view that nowadays one's whole life was spent looking at images, from the Image d'Épinal of childhood to the illustrated rebuses of old age. A significant tranche of this imagery fell under the broad description of caricature. In the early years of the Third Republic, a strict regime of censorship, inherited from the Second Empire, was in place to keep political caricature under control. Even after the election of a truly republican ministry in December 1877, this continued, and the censorship laws were invoked not only against illustrated political periodicals on the left, such as La Lune Rousse, and on the right, such as Le Tribulé, but also against purveyors of mainstream smut, such as Le Boudoir. However, by the turn of the decade, a consensus was reached that censorship was no longer necessary. Both political extremes were suffering equally, and the Republic felt strongly enough it established in the centre to act. Like returning the Chamber of Deputies to Paris from Versailles, adopting the Marseillaise and the 14 Juillet as national anthem and fête, lifting censorship was a symbolic republican reform, a ringing expression of liberté. The new law on the liberty of press took effect on the 29th of July, 1881. One of the results was a boom in the caricatural press. In 1879, with censorship in place, 26 new caricatural journals had been started in France. The following year, in expectation of reform, 49 began. Between 1881 and 1914, some 130 were launched, an extraordinary flowering. Although government retained some powers, it could ban images deemed obscene or offensive to the army or the President of the Republic, and the current president is rather touchy about voodoo dolls in his image, the cat was out of the bag. The Republic's liberal legislation gave rise to caricatural culture, a culture embracing different kinds of the comic, from the satirical to the bawdy, the disrespectful to the ridiculous, and it deepened the hold of the caricatural on the wider public mentalité. As a mentalité, the caricatural was emphatically modern. It thrived on the here and now, pillorying the politician of the moment, mocking the latest fashion, satirizing the current fad. Thus, it suited the fast-moving tempo of the age and provided comic copy and humorous illustrations for the thriving press of the day. In 1892, there were over 2,000 daily papers in Paris alone, with another 3,500 in the provinces, all needing material, many wanting images. The caricatural used new technologies, for instance, phototypography, for the cheap, rapid printing of images. Above all, it cross-pollinated with other forms. The caricatural enlivened the poster, itself an exciting new medium, reliant on instant impact for its commercial purpose and modern printing methods for its production. The work of the first great poster designer, Jules Chéret, essentially fused the brazen simplicity of caricature with lurid colour to give a commercial pitch arresting visual impact. In the wake of the 1881 law, new forms of entertainment burgeoned, in particular the cabaret artistique. The most famous of these, the Chat Noir, was founded in Montmartre in 1881 and based its reputation on the ironically excessive politeness of its director, Rodolphe Salis, the often satirical material of its singers and poets, the caricatures of its house periodical, and the success of its shadow plays. Here is Salis here behind the bar, welcoming people in and grovelling to them sarcastically. And here is a photograph of people from the Chat Noir. And the young man in Japanese costume down there is the painter Paul Signac. The caricatural was pivotal to the décor of the Chat Noir. Adolphe Willette's Parche Domine adopted the huge scale and energised neo-baroque of much republican public decoration, only to pervert its civic values, replacing labour with debauchery, family with prostitution, the virile duty of the Frenchman with the pitiful Pierrot driven to suicide by excess. In the mid-1880s, Willett also contributed to the Chat Noir a stained glass window, Te Deum Laudamus, in which death conducts a performance of social chaos, including infanticide, venal seduction, and proletarian insurrection, presided over by a fat golden calf identified on his crown as Israel. Scurrilous, anti-Semitic, and anti-republican, such works showed the ambitious scale on which the caricatural might operate. A later cabaret artistique, L'Enfer, was themed as a visit to hell, and its decorated facade revelled in the grotesque, a crucial aspect of the caricatural. Another cultural form, the café corsaire, the French equivalent of the music hall, had traded in the comic and the bawdy since its emergence in mid-century. But as it became increasingly commercialised and reliant on visual imagery, notably the poster, for its promotion, the café corsaire played on its caricatural credentials. The young Yvette Guibert was mocked on her debut in 1889 because she was flat-chested, compared to successful stars like the formidable Madame Bloch. Guibert devised a costume which exaggerated her lack of bust and skinny arms, her ironic reversal of the bosomy norm, giving her a very sharply defined visual identity, well adapted to the poster and illustration. Combining that with easily distortable facial features and a repertoire of risque songs, Guibert became the highly successful embodiment of the caricatural. As she described her act in her memoirs, "I decided that it must be lewd, mingled with veiled satire, but direct all the same, deal with all the immodesties, excesses and vices of my contemporaries in a sung display of humorous cartoons and make them laugh at themselves." I will not sing you one of Yvette Guibert's songs, but one of them was called Le Fiacre, the handsome cab, and the chorus goes, "Oopla, oopla, oopla," to describe a rather vigorous and delightful activity taking place in the back. Illustrated press, comic journals, posters, cabaret artistique, café concert, all these forms were modern, and their common characteristic was the caricatural. Woven so closely into the fabric of popular culture, the caricatural became a crucial ingredient in the mentalité of modernity. It also existed in literature too, and one finds in novels very, very humorous anecdotes and moments. In Octave Mirbeau's Le Jardin des Supplices, which is really a rather grim novel about sadism, there's a wonderful bit of humour at the beginning, which is totally gratuitous. A man is released from prison and needs a job, so he goes to see an old school friend of his who happens to be a cabinet minister. And the minister says, "Oh, just out of prison, need a job? You should become a member of parliament. There's a constituency up in the north, almost on the Belgian border, that needs a member. Go up there. When you make a speech, however, remember one thing. It's a single-issue constituency. Say nothing in your speeches about foreign affairs, the law, education or health. They're interested in one thing only. Beetroot." Both caricature as a medium and the caricatural as a mentalité were crucial axes in French culture between 1880 and 1900. 1882 saw the foundation of the Salon des Incohérents, which exhibited caricatures of artworks and visual puns, typically made by amateurs. There, the humorist Alphonse Allais famously showed a blank sheet of white paper entitled First Communion of Anemic Girls in a Snowstorm, which you see at lower right. The one at lower left, the red one, is called something like Tomato Harvest by Apoplectic Cardinals on the Banks of the Red Sea. In 1888, a survey exhibition of 19th century caricature and anecdotal painting was held at no less a venue than the École des Beaux-Arts, giving caricature an official entree into French artistic tradition. The work of contemporary caricaturists and poster designers also became part of Parisian exhibition culture. Ouillette held a one-man show in 1888 and Chéret the following year. Here were artists working in popular, commercial, caricatural media presenting themselves ambitiously. 1890 saw the launch of the liberal Salon National des Beaux-Arts, a secession from the more conservative Salon des Artistes Français, which manifested its aesthetic tolerance by admitting caricatures. For example, at its first exhibition, Jean-Louis Forain exhibited 23 drawings that had been published in the risqué Montmartre weekly Le Courrier Français. Important books were being published. 1888 saw both Grand Carteret's monumental Les Mœurs et la Caricature en France, a sweeping historical survey, and Arsène Alexandre's monograph on the great caricaturist Daumier, who had died a decade earlier. Both were scholarly, well-illustrated volumes by authors who continued to publish in the field. In 1894, Alexandre produced an important book, L'art du rire et de la caricature, and launched a new periodical, Le Rire, to which artists like Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec contributed caricatures like this one, which is known as Chocolat Dancing. Of course, if Carol Thatcher had said Chocolat, she would have been in trouble. I am talking about Toulouse-Lautrec and history. Artists ensured that their work had lasting impact, collecting drawings for ephemeral papers and journals in volumes. These might be a cross-section of an artist's work, like Forain's La Comédie Parisienne of 1892, Here's a Prostitute, Enfin Seul, or Steinlen's Dans la Vie of 1901. All these volumes might focus on a particular issue. Forain's 1893 Les Temps Difficiles, for instance, poked fun at Republican politicians' corruption during the Panama scandal, while Hermann Pohl's innocuously titled De Son Dessin of 1900 collected his caricatures in support of Dreyfus. Because of their typical range of subject, the periodicals in which they published, or the particular political stance they adopted, such draftsmen pleased specific publics, and between them, a whole range of taste and opinion. But caricature was not merely a question of target and wit. It was also one of style. Other artists, often with utterly different objectives, admired and collected caricature. Serious artists by no means dismissed caricaturists' gifts. The highly economical drawings of Alfred Grévin there on the left were savoured by Édouard Manet and Jean-Jacques Henner. Forain's, there on the right, by Degas and Cézanne. There were major reputations to be made. The prolific Alfred Robida created a series of fine caricatural books, like Le XXe siècle of 1883, poking fun at the next century. Here, the flying machines, he imagined. Even the decoration of public spaces was confided to artists working in a caricatural mode. This may have begun with collaborators in cabaret artistique, Ouillette decorating the Chat Noir, for example. But by the 1890s, Forain and Jean Weber had been commissioned to decorate the Café Riche on the Boulevard des Italiens, now destroyed, and Chéret given a whole room in the Hôtel de Ville. I should perhaps close this sketch of the context of the caricatural by shifting from the ridiculous to the sublime. In the Revue de Paris of early 1899, Henri Bergson turned his pellucid analytical gaze on the comic in his study Le Rire. If one of France's leading intellectuals was taking laughter seriously, then the caricatural was deeply entrenched in the public mentalité. The law of the 29th of July 1881 had let the genie out of the bottle, stimulating a caricatural consensus which accepted the satirical, ribald and disrespectful as a vivid aspect of modern culture. Such an attitude was only enhanced by a political climate in which the usual stew of self-interest and pomposity was laced with jobbery and corruption. Just take a couple of contemporary presidents of the Republic. Grévy was forced to resign in 1887 because his son-in-law was peddling honours. Four, literally, died in his office in 1899, his corpse pinning his terrified mistress to the presidential sofa. Am I allowed to say shagging in a Slade lecture? My central concern in this lecture is to what extent this new climate affected art, and especially independent art. Painters had engaged with caricature before. Hogarth is an obvious example, and in the immediately preceding generation, both Degas and Monet had flirted with the medium. But what could avant-garde painters of the 1880s and 90s, who had matured within this mentalité, learn from caricature in terms of style? To what extent was the dominant naturalism taken in new directions, given a new edge or acerbity by caricatural possibilities? Did caricature offer to independent young painters, seeking to elude the naturalist consensus, stylistic possibilities they could develop? After all, descriptive naturalism was typically very earnest and might be lacking in irony. To enhance the caricatural aspects of one's work would emphasise one's independence from the dominant aesthetic and one's embrace of a modern mentalité. The Littré Dictionary of the 1880s defined caricature as the grotesque representation of people or events that one wishes to ridicule. But within that broad understanding, we need to identify what caricature offered in terms of its stylistic possibilities. In particular, how was it modern? In 1892, the British art critic, P.G. Hamerton, who had kept French art under close scrutiny for 30 years, wrote that caricature, which he took to be a delight in making people hideous and the intentional deterioration of bodily form, had a particular character in France. French caricature, Hamerton sniffed, was too much infected with silliness and impurity, but at its best combined a sense of the ridiculous with a love of elegance in costume and form and of grace in attitude. At first glance, this looks unpromising. Avant-garde artists of this period were certainly concerned with style. Painters such as Seurat and Gauguin were interested in simplifying drawing to arrive at a synthèse, synthetic form, in exaggerated chromatic effects no longer enslaved to local colour, in the organisation of touch to achieve a decorative surface harmony. All these were initiatives to extract innovative painting from the descriptive duties of naturalism, by the later 1880s, bringing it closer to the emerging aesthetic of symbolism, which sought to replace the descriptive with the evocative and suggestive. If this was the momentum of the avant-garde, then the terms Littré or Hamerton used to deal with the caricatural, grotesque, ridiculous, the deterioration of bodily form, would seem to have little purchase on the issue. Might one argue that when young artists contributed caricatures to illustrated periodicals, they were simply trying to get their work seen, a tactic peripheral to their ambitions as painters? Avant-garde artists rarely exhibited at the Anco-Erhon. Indeed, the differences of visual language between the two spheres, caricature and the avant-garde, might be very deliberately distinct. In 1876, the caricaturist André Gilles and writer Félicien Champsaur had set up Les Hommes d'aujourd'hui, a series of folded single-sheet profiles that ran for over two decades, with a caricature cover to a brief biographical sketch. The graphic format for the cover, established by Gilles, was continued by successors such as Émile Cole and Luc. Cole's 1898 drawing of Toulouse-Lautrec on the left typifies it, the stock caricaturist's solution of much enlarged head, minimised body, and a certain exaggeration of the facial features, the portrait charge. But when avant-garde artists occasionally drew covers for Les Hommes d'aujourd'hui, they didn't feel obliged to adopt the conventions of another idiom. Instead, they emphasised their individuality, their synthèse, as Émile Bernard did with his 1891 drawing of Vincent van Gogh. But I would like to argue that the caricatural was more than an alien idiom, more than an occasional excursion for the contemporary avant-garde. caricature offered a multiplicity of stylistic possibilities and pictorial innovations. Take, as an example, a single page by Uzès from the Chat Noir Cabaret's journal of the 27th of February, 1886. In the lower section, it shows the Chat Noir's bohemian initiates gathered around the piano and puppet theatre, with the caricatured head of the artist Henri Rivière to far right. There is the exaggerated head and smaller body in the central figure of the Chat Noir's owner, Rodolphe Salis. The use of silhouette, soon to be developed in the Chat Noir's famous shadow plays. The synthetic drawing used overall, sometimes noticeably distorting the human form, as in the elegantly clad woman to the left. And the grotesque and violent, as in the guillotining to the upper right. There is also play with the up-to-the-minute. Not only do we see celebrities like President Grévy, identified by his mutton chops in the centre, but also to the far left, the big-nosed profile of the actress Sarah Bernhardt. The Bernhardt is one of several hybrid forms that combine quasi-human heads, one even top-hatted, with weird limbs and wriggling bodies. These microbe-like creatures remind us that it was during the 1880s that the researchers of Pasteur and others were revealing that human life is dependent on the interactions of microscopic organisms. Uzès's drawing thus engages with the modern at multiple levels. Made for the caricatural and cabaret culture released by the 1881 law, it inventories innovative pictorial idioms and engages them with the political and scientific discourses of the day. What could be drawn from caricature that might be called caricatural? We can outline two broad areas. The first was the synthetic. As I've mentioned, synthèse was a term much used amongst the avant-garde from the mid-1880s, identifying an economy of draftsmanship which broke with both the academic idealisation taught in the art schools and the scrupulously observed precision of naturalism. But if this reduction of forms to essentials came to be seen by the later 1880s as a means by which pictorial art could ally itself with the emergent symbolist aesthetic, synthèse in drawing had long been an admired feature of caricatural draftsmanship. Alfred Grévin's extremely economical drawings of Parisienne had a well-established reputation by 1880, collected in albums like L'Esprit des Femmes of 1873, and were even held up by women's fashion magazines as the silhouette to which one should aspire. But the single crucial painting that announced in the mid-1880s that painting was going off in another direction was Seurat's A Sunday on the Grand Jatte, 1884. Notwithstanding a modern subject of suburban leisure that would have adapted effortlessly to naturalistic treatment, Seurat's painting manifested utterly opposed stylistic possibilities. These included a visibly ordered touch, unresponsive to particular textures, a systematization of the chromatics to stimulate optical vibration, and a resolutely synthetic drawing emphasizing silhouette, not spontaneous movement. These initiatives had various stimuli, among them optical theory and the work of older painters, not least Puvis de Chavannes. But in this context, one point is of vital importance. Seurat's stylized and highly simplified drawing, ritualized almost to the point of ridicule, derived from the kind of caricatural drawing that had proliferated after 1881. The Grand Jatte set the example for how a new kind of painting could skirt naturalism, basing itself in the synthetic and caricatural rather than the descriptive. It could well have been painted to resemble naturalist mairie decorations, such as Gervex's Civil Marriage of 1881. Instead, by opting for the stiff and simplified, Seurat introduced stylistic elements that not only distanced his painting from the dominant naturalism, but suggested some kind of satire on republicanism's vaunted fraternal collectivity. A second area in which the caricatural fueled innovation was in the exaggeration of form. The post-1881 mentalité encouraged the satirical. The grotesque could slip in to spice up the descriptive. An artist with an acute eye for the comic, like Lautrec, could switch into an appropriately caricatural idiom in his paintings. Dr. Payor Operating was made about 1891. Lautrec had watched and sketched the famous surgeon at work, and his painting uses the naturalistic device of the fragmentary foreground figure to give a sense of peering over his shoulder to see the procedure. But Lautrec reduced the descriptive, focusing on Payon's hand, carefully manipulating his instrument midway between two faces. Both of these, surgeons and patients, come close to caricature. Payon's a heavy, hook-nosed portrait charge. The patient's a grotesque, chloroformed rictus. Alongside Lautrec's quickfire image, Gervex's 1887 salon painting seems less a modern image of the pioneering surgeon forwarding his science than a ponderous lesson about progress and professional worth. To a greater or lesser degree, in detail or across a whole composition, artists such as Lautrec could use the grotesque or the distorted to shift away from the descriptive, bland, styleless and unironic, to give their art an edge. Avant-garde artists used the caricatural as a tactic to negotiate their positions vis-à-vis the dominant naturalism. Forain, who operated both as painter and caricaturist, typically stretched the boundaries of naturalism in that direction. At the 1879 Impressionist exhibition, gouaches like The Client, The Judgment of Paris, scabrously replayed in a modern brothel, announced his caricatural credentials. Paintings such as The Fisherman of 1884, in which the portly angler and his poodle sit precariously above the river, show that even naturalistic painting, in the right hands, could take on a gently ironic inflection. But as the 1880s moved on, the younger generation drew even more incisively on caricatural qualities to give their work a modern, comic, or critical sharpness, so that they came to characterise personal style. Between 1887 and 1891, both the young Toulouse-Lautrec and Louis Anquetin used the possibilities of caricature as a passage out of naturalism. This was in reaction to their training in the studio of Fernand Cormon, whose stock in trade was academic naturalism, his subjects frequently the accurate description of the prehistoric past. Around 1886-7, Lautrec and Anquetin frequented Le Mirliton, the cabaret artistique of Aristide Brouhon. Brouhon bellowed out roughly hewn songs about the tough working-class life of the Paris backstreets in proletarian slang, in what passed as an authentic whiff of lowlife. This somewhat ersatz climate of social realism engrossed Lautrec and Anquetin for a while. Lautrec titled some of his portraits after Brouhon's songs. This one on the right is Amour Rouge, while Anquetin planned a major painting based on Le Mirliton, never completed, and this drawing on the left is a study for that picture with Émile Bernard posing for it. Such painting might still have been essentially descriptive, but Lautrec also contributed caricatures to the cabaret's periodical. This one is one titled, How Old Are You, Sweetie? 15, monsieur. Getting on a bit. Brouhon's confrontational persona taught the two young artists that subject was one thing, pictorial phrasing another. Both Anquetin and Lautrec insinuated the grotesque and with it the aggressive into their work. Take two circus scenes made in 1887-8. Anquetin's apparently playful colours actually grate, and the red-coated, green-faced clown seems to threaten rather than extol his juggling colleague, as the paunchy ringmaster looks on from the shadows. Lautrec's Au Cirque Fernando also has a sinister undertow beneath the surface jollity. The audience seems distant and unengaged. The bareback rider, heavily maquillé, flouncily skirted, tights visible up to her buttocks, faces a swaggering, leering ringmaster as virile as the stallion she rides and whose whip is their means of communication. Instead of directly describing the visual experience of the circus, as Tissot had done in paintings from his Femmes à Paris series exhibited in 1885, Lautrec and Anquetin used the exaggerated devices of the caricatural, particularly the grotesque and the incipiently violent, as means of characterising the edgy jollity of circus performance far more acutely than mere surface description. Anquetin arrived at a pitch of stylization in 1889 with the roundabout at the Champs-Élysées, which uses synthetic drawings to exaggerate the mannered prancing of the well-groomed horses and pitches complementary contrasts of red and green, muted blue and orange against each other. This repudiation of the descriptive is continued in the distortion of the figure into an impossibly trim silhouette, echoed by her beribboned and mustachioed poodle. By the early 1890s, it had become a critical commonplace to compare Anquetin's and Lautrec's work to Daumier and the caricatural tradition. In 1892, Arsène Alexandre's important historical study of caricature, L'Art du Rire, illustrated Lautrec's recent painting, A la Mie. Among a host of caricatures, it was the only painting that Alexandre reproduced, as if he understood that Lautrec was currently working in territory which fused painting and caricature. Indeed, when compared to a similar naturalist subject, such as Raffaelli's Absinthe Drinkers, an 1881 painting exhibited at the 1889 Salon, Lautrec's A la Mie has both a graphic, improvised quality and a searingly astute eye for vices inscribed on the face, which qualify it as caricatural. Alexandre's book also illustrated the upper section of Lautrec's first poster, published only a year before. At one level, this was understandable, for Moulin Rouge, La Goulue is a veritable index of the stylistic possibilities of the caricatural, synthetic drawing, the silhouette, distortion, and the grotesque. At another, it must have seemed radical in 1892 to include a poster designed to market a contemporary dance hall and a performer in a historical survey of caricature. But Alexandre seems to have sensed that caricatural stylistic means and the new commercial medium of the poster could comfortably coalesce because both were emphatically modern. If Lautrec and Anquetin had used the caricatural as a means to distance themselves from the naturalism in which they had been trained, for Seurat it was a path out of the classicism with which he had been imbued at the École des Beaux-Arts in the 1870s. Already, when the Grand Jatte had been exhibited in 1886, many critics had responded to its stylistic innovations by reading them in playful terms, comparing the simplified figures to tin soldiers or images d'Épinal. The naturalist writer Paul Alexis had found the picture très farce. 4 years later, when Seurat exhibited Chahut at the 1890 Salon des Indépendants, his use of the caricatural had gone further. Chahut was a radical painting by any standards. It made use of the psychophysical ideas of the eccentric theoretician Charles Henry, who linked the direction of lines to colours as a means of preordaining emotional response. Thus, the dancers kicked up legs, rising above the horizontal and angled from the right, into play with the warm oranges and pinks to stimulate the response of gaiety, according to Henri. Seurat absorbed what he needed of Henri's theories within his own pointillé touch and stylistic mannerisms. Look at the halation, the dark peripheries to the strongly lit areas, and the tidily repetitive shadows at the dancers' feet. Since the Grande Jatte, Seurat's drawing had become more sinuous, well adapted to the licentiousness of the dance hall subject. This also involved absorption, this time from caricatural imagery. For Chaul recalls drawings such as Robida's ballet rehearsal at the Folie Musicale of 1884, in which grinning faces and ritualistically lewd leg-lifting routines increase their ridiculousness by repetition. Chaul's design, with its musicians cut off by the lower edges of the picture, its bassist seen from behind, and its fragments of the flautist's fingers, was itself a play on naturalist compositional devices, which in turn were commonplace in caricature and illustration. As the admiring Belgian painter Henri van der Velde noted in 1890, the painting represented a quadrille naturaliste, a variant on the can-can so named for its extra lubricity. Naturalism having entered the daily parlance of the entertainment industry and the dance hall as shorthand for the smutty. Chaul was thus a complex brew of styles and associations, merging Montmartre entertainment culture and scientific theories about perception with advanced painting technique, stylizing the clichés of naturalist composition. Chaul fused the modern and the caricatural and read that way. As van der Velde put it, in these facts, so in this most immediate modernity, these clubs, dressing rooms, cat houses, oh, irony. Modern, by definition, caricature does not just target the subject of the moment. It also uses contemporary associations, plugs into mentalité. As Bergson pointed out in his study of laughter, part of the joke is getting the public to make the connection. Artists working within the caricatural, as well as caricaturists, often drew on contemporary scientific associations, and responses to their work acknowledged this. By the 1880s, the new psychology of Jean-Martin Charcot and others, exploring hysteria and the subconscious, had permeated the social understanding of the informed public. Writers frequently used it for analogies with work they found disturbing. The decadent writer Jean Lorrain, who revelled in the louche and the marginal, thought Adolphe Ouellette's neurotic, violent imagery shared its modernity with Charcot's experiments with disturbed states of mind. The older naturalist novelist Edmond de Goncourt, however, used the contemporary fascination with states of mind damningly when he dismissed Odillon Redon's lithographs as done at Bicêtre, a mental hospital, by a senile old man seated on a chaise percée. Goncourt's opinion was insulting, but not gratuitous. The title Obsession for a hallucinatory 1894 lithograph was surely a bow on Redon's part to the developing interest in psychology. But although Redon's work was far from naturalism, his fantastic imagery was nourished by science. He was interested in microscopic organisms, a field we've already noted was increasingly coming into public attention in the 1880s with the discoveries of Pasteur and others. Indeed, in 1883, the artist sent the famous chemist his album, Les Origines, and Pasteur wrote back, congratulating Redon on his ability to give life to monstrosities. Redon's instinct for the grotesque interplayed with his scientific interests. Many of the fantastic forms which populate Redon's charcoals and lithographs were extraordinary hybrids. They were invented by drawing on visual idioms as diverse as past art, scientific illustration, and caricature, and on scientific discovery, including Pasteurian microbiology and Darwinian evolutionary theory. Typically, this involved a process of transformation, in which the figure, as you see here, becomes a kind of mutant, a combination of the human and the animal, vegetable, or floral. Rendering human elements grotesque by such visual hybridization brings forward suggestions about that being's origins and true nature, its failed or flawed evolution, even its regression. Here, the Darwinian met the caricatural. For such metamorphoses were a device in caricature, used, for example, in the cruel series of prints, Fleurs, Fruits et Légumes du Jour, which Alfred Le Petit had produced during the Paris Commune of 1871. One might compare Le Petit's caricature of the senior Republican Edgar Quinet as a caterpillar shrinking behind a violet, with the crawling mutant in the first plate of Redon's Les Origines, or his print of the lawyer Adolphe Crémieux with Redon's charcoal Cactus Man. Works like these, where Redon came closest to the caricatural idiom of a Le Petit, date from the early 1880s, and one suspects that the liberation of caricature in 1881 stimulated Redon's fascination with the metamorphic grotesque. The Darwinian theory of evolution, about which we're hearing so much this year, offered a rich field for caricature and the grotesque. Of course, there were endless jokes. 1894, for instance, saw the publication of a book, Man, the Monkey Who Has Degenerated, by a certain Philadelph Gorilla. Inevitably, Darwinian notions made their way into the political caricature of both left and right. This might equally be verbal. Le Chambard Socialiste published a satirical play in 1894 featuring the Bonapartist Marquis de Chimpanzé, or visual, as in Le Nevers' viciously anti-Dreyfusard series Le Musée d'Horreur of 1900. Un bal à l'Élysée, there on the left, transformed Carpeaux's famous sculpture La Danse into a ronde of Dreyfusard, all mutated into beasts. Le Nevers' imagery implied that defending Dreyfus was done by subhumans or involved some regression from human to ape or pig. Darwin's theories dealt with evolution, the competitive progress of species, and also with degeneration, the failure to compete and adapt. Such ideas were widely adopted in late 19th century French in France in diagnoses of the nation's ills. Symptoms such as the worryingly sluggish birth rate compared to rival nations like Germany, the rise in alcohol consumption, and the spread of sexually transmitted diseases were interpreted by many in terms of national degeneration. Such a medico-scientific reading of the state of the nation was itself symptomatic, one might add, of the Republican commitment to modern positivist analyses. In this context, it was inevitable that much caricature of the 1880s and 90s was concerned at one level or another with the notion of degeneration or decadence, and thus with morality. Indeed, there was a lively crossover between medico-scientific ideas and artists' imagery. In 1892, the German doctor Max Nordau published his book Degeneration, a fierce attack on contemporary French culture and morality. Nordau identified what he called stigmata, the physical characteristics of the degenerate. These symptoms included bodily deformities, asymmetrical features, exaggerated ears, and squint eyes. A veritable inventory of caricatural devices. The reputations of artists such as Toulouse-Lautrec were based on this kind of reading of their work. As André Malherio wrote of Lautrec in 1896, he seems to be an artist in tune with, but not resistant to his epoch, vice-ridden to the point of morbidity. Indeed, artists played up this type of persona. Take Gauguin's relief, Soyez Amoureuse, carved in 1899. Gauguin himself appears to upper right, his hooked nose exaggerated and a thumb coarsely shoved into his mouth. In a letter of November 1889, he described how behind him was the festering city of Babylon, while a demon's hand reaches out to the left to grab the woman's arm. The imagery may be allusive and the carving deliberately crude, but Soyez Amoureuse relies for its reading on assumptions about contemporary decadence and the caricatural as the means to articulate them. Much the same can be said about Jean Carrière's contemporary Porte de Parsifal. This contemporary portal was commissioned in 1890 by the Princesse du Skey Montbéliard. That sounds a wonderfully aristocratic name, but she was actually Winnaretta Singer with a fortune from sewing machines. And she commissioned it as the entrance to the room in which she would keep her newly acquired manuscript of Richard Wagner's Parsifal. Unfinished on Carrière's death in 1894, we know the port only from a watercolour and completed fragments. In the centre of the door would have been a commanding female figure who seems to dominate the grotesques which form the arch. Some of these, such as the frog-like men to upper left and right, remind one of Redon's hybrid creatures with their suggestion of degenerate evolution. Much as the Third Republic sought to identify itself with scientific progress, artists such as Redon, Gauguin and Carrière could twist that optimistic rhetoric into forms which caricatured evolutionary rationality. I want to close by looking briefly at two artists emerging in the early 1890s and with whom the caricatural seems to have been an inherent characteristic of their ways of seeing, Pierre Bonnard and Édouard Vuillard. There is a consistent vein of humour in Bonnard's 1890s work, though the extent to which this was innate or cultivated by the post-1881 mentalité in which he matured is a matter of speculation. Bonnard's friends, like the actor Lugnier Poe and the critic Malherio, recognised that his wit had both frivolous and satirical aspects, his urban imagery in particular having an edgy and nervous touchiness. That almost diagnostic reading applies, for example, to the poster Bonnard drafted in 1891 for the Moulin Rouge in a competition eventually won by Toulouse-Lautrec. Bonnard also elected to centre on the high-kicking chahuteurs. The image is caricatural in the way its striking synthetic line economically defines the blithely self-absorbed features of the retroussé-nosed dancer and the leering gentleman punters behind her. The figures are shot through with flashing yellow contours, giving the image a vibration like an electric shock. This draws attention to her hands scrabbling to lift her skirts, and underneath them the lewd, inviting, tous les soirs. If Bonnard's poster design demonstrated his currency in the democratic idiom, his family pictures are gentle, self-parodying class caricatures. But they also play with naturalist devices such as cropping, so that style becomes part of the comedy. Exaggerated close-ups no longer about immediacy, but about family foibles. The 1891 Drinks in the Garden crams his family's heads into a tight pictorial space in an exaggerated parody of the naturalist device of cropping forms. Bonnard's grandmother, Madame Merzdorf, clasps a glass of liqueur, while his brother-in-law, Charles Terrasse, raises a cup to his bearded mouth. Even the cat's face is treated equivalently in this medley of friendly face features. If in Drinks in the Garden, deliberately overplayed proximity finds a nice balance between the intimate and the ridiculous, in Grandmother and Child of about 1895, dark and light are the key formal features. The pale, egg-like sphere of the baby's head contrasts with Madame Merzdorf's sombre features, deeply grooved like a rough carving. Bonnard makes us watch from across the tablecloth, affectionately distanced from this scene of age and infancy, each quietly comic. Bonnard could be both crueler and more playful in his prints. Conversation was intended as an illustration to the avant-garde's caricatural periodical L'Escarmouche in 1893. Here, proximity is rendered silly, yet oppressive. Bonnard exaggerated the man's thin, curved jaw under his open mouth, long nose and seemingly closed eyes, making the woman look surprised or horrified, mouth and eyes wide open. Crucially, style matters here. Look at how she is drawn in nervous touches and muted tones with no cohesive linearity. He is all contour, dominated by that dark, hyperbolic moustache. Vuillard's work is less obviously caricatural than his friend Bonnard's, but for both of them, the caricatural helped slough off naturalism for an art that made more of personal style, indeed played with style. If Vuillard was less spontaneously humorous than Bonnard, he made the most of his circumstances, friendships with illustrators for the caricatural press like Oswald Heidbrink and actors like Lounier Poe. Lounier had done his training at the Paris Conservatoire under the famous Coquelin brothers, and around 1890 he introduced Vuillard to Coquelin Cadet. Renowned as an interpreter of Molière, Coquelin Cadet was also a performer of comic monologues, glorying in titles like The Lovesick Earthworm and The Man Giving a Monologue. And it was in this mode that Jean Barrault painted him in 1882. As an art collector, Coquelin's taste was for naturalist work, such as his friend Barrault's or Émile Friant's. But in 1890-91, Coquelin bought a number of watercolours by Vuillard, representing him performing Molière. These are very cursorily drawn, their sharp silhouettes responding to the shadow plays in vogue at the Cabaret Artistique, and their bright colours and schematic features to Japanese woodcuts of actors. Vuillard made these watercolours for ready cash. But why did Coquelin want these daringly reductive images, so different from his established taste? Coquelin was a founder member of the Salon des Incohérents, at which he exhibited. With an acute sense of the comic, he must have appreciated the economy with which Vuillard caught the extravagantly exaggerated movements of these scenes from Molière, perhaps admiring a form of representation which was not descriptive, but rather sought to find a style which was as comic in itself as the performance it evoked. Vuillard noted in his journal that he could not draw men without slipping into caricature, which indicates how entrenched he felt his caricatural way of seeing was. He was also striving to reduce his inclination to exactitude, writing in late summer 1890, "A woman's head has just given me a certain emotion. This emotion alone must prompt me, and I must not try to remember a nose or an ear. That doesn't matter at all." A little painting, like Woman with a Bonnet in Profile, made about this time, takes such admonitions to heart. Nose and ear are reduced, like the rest, to schemas, but in a distillation of mood and movement which conveys a coy anxiety through stylistic means, the hunched silhouette, pallid chromatics, restless salad of a hat. How different this is from the passing profiles of the women in Friant's contemporary All Saints' Day, with its detailed ears and noses. Vuillard achieved synthesis via the caricatural. The caricatural gave artists the right to invent, exaggerate, and even ridicule, rather than describe. Why was this current pervasive? Because it was modern. The caricatural was closely linked to cabaret culture, the poster, the entertainment industry. It drew from the innovative ideas of science and medicine. Because the caricatural engaged with such significant modern discourses, because it was itself a vivid dimension in the mentalité of modernity, the caricatural helped the artist to reach out to new audiences. Through the medium of modern technologies such as the illustrated press, artists could engage a wider public than the exhibition visitor. That wider audience was still predominantly bourgeois, the powerhouse of the Third Republic. The prevalence of the caricatural was double-edged for the Republic. Caricatural culture had been released by the libertarian reform of 1881, but that spiralling culture not only lifted the censorship of political caricature, it went much further, drawing attention to France's modern problems, most notably the troubling issue of degeneration. In addition, by encouraging young artists into caricatural modes, it drew them away from the dominant naturalism, which functioned in so many ways to support the Republican consensus. Young painters who were uncommitted to that consensus, or opposed to it, would be drawn to a style outside it. The caricatural was a complex phenomenon, bridging many different cultural, social, and political processes, and it richly inflected the work of many artists. It is, I would argue, a more useful way of considering this period than the nebulous concept of post-impressionism. Thank you.